Good evening, this is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My returning guest tonight, always a pleasure to talk to him, is Brian Fagan, Emeritus Professor of Anthropology, University of California, Santa Barbara. We're talking about his latest book, A Little History of Archaeology. Brian, it's such a pleasure to talk to you again. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. It's a real pleasure to be back.
This book blew my socks off. I mean, first of all, I knew a lot of little separate things about the history of archaeology, but this book really gives it the grand sweep right up into contemporary times. But it's part of a series. Talk to me about you were laboring under very strict guidelines for this series.
Yeah, Yale University Press, actually the English branch of Yale University Press, have done this fairly successful series, which began, I believe, with a book called A Little History of the World, or something like that, which was very successful, and they've now expanded it to science and philosophy and various subjects like that, including now archaeology. And they came to me, it must have been about 2 years ago now, and asked me to do this, and I hadn't even heard of the series, actually. But was very flattered. Anytime Yale asks you to do something, you do it. Was very flattered, and then they laid on me the guidelines, which are 40 chapters, 2,000 words each, and the emphasis of the series is on both the people who were the prominent figures in the history, and also what happened. And the conspectus was from the beginning right up to today.
And that's exactly what your little history of archaeology is. It's very character-driven.
Yeah, and their editing is rigorous.
Oh, yeah.
Very high standard, which makes sure that the series is very tight.
But this book is just, I enjoyed it beginning to end. Every chapter is like a new page in the history of archaeology. And the science of archaeology really has an interesting evolution. It's not like a lot of other sciences. And I want to talk about that. I mean, in the beginning, it was basically – the thing that surprises me, you start off talking about John Aubrey, 1626 to 1697, wondering about Stonehenge. And for me, I thought like that brought something up. Like people were living around these ruins – for hundreds of years, did they never think about them?
They thought of Avebury and indeed Stonehenge as sources of building stone.
Oh my God, or looting them.
Well, looting is almost the wrong word. These were subsistence farmers living from harvest to harvest. Life was brutally difficult, very tough. I mean, forget all the idealistic scenes you see of medieval farmers. It was a pretty brutal life. And everyone in their lifetime was familiar with malnutrition and hunger and poor harvests. And they were, to a great degree, self-sufficient. And if there was building stone nearby, they used it. They knew it was built by people before, but it wasn't important to them because their lives revolved entirely around two things. One was the cycle of the seasons, planting and harvest, life and death. And the other one, of course, was the Christian, the scriptures, because this was a devout age. So they quarried the stuff for stone.
Jeez,
they didn't take a large quantity in some cases, but they did. They did it all kinds of buildings. They did it all over the world.
One of the earlier chapters, and I want to emphasize for the benefit of the audience, we can in no way do justice to this book because there's so much that's in this book. One of the earliest chapters was Napoleon in Egypt. Now, it's in this case, archaeology sort of happens in spite of what's going on because Napoleon's there to have a big war and conquest, and he just happens to bring with him what he calls his donkeys, his scientists. And they end up making some pretty important discoveries in the Egyptian ruins.
They were absolutely amazing. Actually, Napoleon had a fairly profound interest in science. And the purpose of the donkeys was to discover or to acquire knowledge about all aspects of Egypt, ancient and modern. And this they did, and they were an extremely gifted group of people, headed by a guy called Vivant Denon, who was, incidentally, an extremely gifted pornographer into the bargain. And they fanned out all over Egypt, following the army, galloping under fire, drawing under fire, and they got literally drunk on ancient Egypt. And nobody had ever seen anything like this before on the scale they did. And they came back, and they wrote, which appeared after the Napoleonic Wars, this absolutely enormous book called The Description de l'Egypte, which is a series of huge folio volumes filled with the most exquisite engravings of monuments and artifacts, rather romanticized, and of Egypt as a whole, which really caused a sensation in Europe and started the big sort of scramble for antiquities which followed after the war.
One of the most important things they brought back was the Rosetta Stone.
Yes. And that has quite a colorful history. Oddly enough, the Rosetta Stone itself, historically, archaeologically, is extremely important because it was one of the keys to deciphering hieroglyphs. But ironically, the actual inscription itself is totally unimportant and very routine. But what was important, it was in Greek and in hieroglyphs.
So that you could translate it. Now, people knew Greek, but people had no idea what these hieroglyphs meant at all. And when they were trying to interpret them prior to the Rosetta Stone, they would just make up stories about what was going on based on what they thought the pictures meant.
Yes, they did. And they also consulted Jesuit missionaries in China as to whether it was any form of Chinese. I mean, this was guesswork. But the actual decipherment was a very long, complex process carried out by some very brilliant people, among them Jean-François Champollion, who actually did unlock the key.
Now, some of these early archaeologists are not scientific archaeologists. They're there, and some of them really crossed the line into tomb robbers. I'm thinking about people like Giovanni Belzoni and others. They're just sort of in there for what? For the riches, to try to find something special that they can sell?
There were two things going on. One was money. Giovanni Belzoni was a opportunist, a showman, and he got involved with Egypt almost by accident. He was very good at moving heavy weights because he'd been a theatrical performer, and he was there for the money. So were others. But at the same time, there were some very early people who were extraordinary, who were not very well known, one of whom was a man called John Gardner Wilkinson, who was simply amazing. He lived in a tomb in the Luxor area on the West Bank. He lived in an abandoned tomb, and he and his friends entertained there, and he drew and inscribed a lot of the tombs, and in fact wrote one of the pioneer books on this subject, on the manners and customs of the ancient Egyptians, which is a brilliant book. And he actually had an Egyptian mistress for a while, so it was all very free and easy, but he and others, culminating in a German archaeologist, actually really transformed Egyptology into a serious discipline.
There are times in the early days that it really is like archaeology was a heroic enterprise. When I think of the discovery of the Mayan ruins, as you write about it, by John Lloyd Stephens and Frederick Catherwood. I've been to those sites, and the story that you recount of them discovering Palenque and Uxmal and Kaaba and Copan. Talk about that. I mean, that just sort of seems like something out of a fairy tale book. I mean, it's like ripping good yarns. They're really a fantastic story.
You're being Victorian, ripping. I haven't heard that word for years. But no, they were. They were a fabulous couple because Jean-Laurent Stevens was a very gifted travel writer. And he had the gift of vivid description. And his description of stumbling on Copan and the only sound being the monkeys walking through the dry forest is just absolutely classic. And then Frederick Catherwood was a absolutely meticulously photographic artist. And he produced these extraordinary images.
Oh, my God. I because of your book, I actually Googled them to see them. These are amazing images.
Oh, yes. And there are all sorts of copies if you want to get some. They are really amazing. And they were almost more of a sensation than Stevens's book. But the pair of them together, it was dynamite. They were out there for the thrill, for the discovery. And Stevens said, look, these aren't Egyptian ruins. They're Native American ruins. And that set up the whole of Maya archaeology.
Now, in these days, people were, when I think about archaeology today, it's such a careful, precise science. But these people were actually going to transport the ruins of Copan to New York City.
Oh, yeah.
I couldn't believe that. He bought it for $50.
He did indeed. I think on condition he married one of the local women or something. Oh, no, that was somewhere else. But exhibiting this stuff was big business in those days because they didn't have movies. I mean, it was big. And if you took one of those things and Catherwood's drawings, you would have had a sensation. As it was, they had a best-selling book and a best-selling exhibition.
Now, along the way, there's some very fascinating chapters about things that affected the way people thought about archaeology. Mm-hmm. And one of them is the age of the earth. Figuring out how old things are. I'm thinking about people like William Smith and Sir Charles Lyell. Talk to me about why that is important for archaeology.
Well, what happened in the 19th century, at the time when Charles Darwin produced the theory of evolution and all that, was that the biblical dogma of the creation in 6 days by God was considered to be the literal historical truth, number one. Number two, some, using the genealogies in the Bible, believe it or not, a gentleman called James Lightfoot calculated that the world was founded at 9 a.m. on a Tuesday in 4004 B.C., which, of course, is nonsense. But this, so strong was the shackle of Christian, dogma on people in those days, that there was a great deal of trouble when people discovered stone tools in association with the bones of extinct animals. I mean, this was huge and very controversial until it was shown beyond all doubt this was so, and the theory of evolution opened it up. But you have to remember that in this day and age, something like, I believe, 40%, and that may be a little high, of Americans believe in the literal historical truth of the creation. This is an enduring thing which goes on and on and on. It's almost like some of the nationalist sort of theories about archaeology or the lost continent of Atlantis. People believe this stuff like a religious faith. It is religion, and who am I to tell them they're wrong? But the whole of archaeology really developed, or prehistoric archaeology, out of the showing that this, in fact, was not the age of the earth.
One of the great pleasures of this book is coming across how certain terms that you're familiar with came about. And I'm thinking about the Stone Age, the Bronze Age, and the Iron Age. It's certainly terms most of us have read many, many times, but few people ever thought about who was the first person to come up with that.
A Chinaman in AD 52. Suggested that this was so, as indeed did the Greek author Hesiod. They both did it, but it was a philosophical concept. In the very early 19th century, this rather interesting Dane, Christian Jørgensen Thompson, got involved, and he was curator of the National Museum in Copenhagen in the teens, of the 19th century, and he exhibited the finds on the basis of periods when people had no metal, periods that had just the Stone Age, an area when they had copper and bronze, the Bronze Age, and an Iron Age. And then another archaeologist called Jens Warsaw, another Dane, using burial mound collections, actually proved that the Stone Age came before the Bronze Age and the Iron Age, and this spread all over Europe and eventually into other places too. And the terminology in general, Stone Age, Bronze, is still used as a general term, but it has no actual very rigid chronological meaning anymore because we know now that rigid divisions of the past aren't a good idea.
You're listening to WISN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. Returning guest tonight, always a pleasure to talk to him, is Brian Fagan, Emeritus Professor of Anthropology, University of California, Santa Barbara. And we're talking about his latest book. It's one of those things. It's a fantastic history, but it's also really fun to read, A Little History of Archaeology. One of the things that I love about this book is you really bring the considerations of archaeology very far back. And one of the things I've always have wanted to visit, I've certainly seen photos of the paintings, but I've never been at the site, is the discovery of Altamira and Lascaux and the cave paintings. Talk to me about how Altamira was discovered.
Altamira is a very interesting story. You can't go into the original now. You can go to a replica, which is well worth seeing, as you can at Lascaux in France. I'm terribly lucky. I'm of the age where I actually saw both of them.
Oh, man.
Origins. And Altamira is a particularly vivid one because what happened was there was a Spanish landowner called de Sautola, a wealthy man, who owned Altamira Cave, and he decided to dig in it because he'd heard about the French Stone Age caves. And this is said to be a true story, although one doesn't know. His 9-year-old daughter begged to come with him, got bored with the excavation, which was muddy, and wandered into the cave with a candle and came in the sine chamber, and suddenly her father heard her shouting, "Toros, Toros, bull, bull." And he rushed to her side, as a father would do, and there were these gorgeous polychrome
oh my God.
Bison on the ceiling. And the ceiling is low. It's only about 7 or 8 feet high. And you look at the bison, and there are bulges in the rock, and they're painted on the bulges. It is really something. And to see it with a flickering light when the figures would move.
Wow.
Must have been an extraordinary experience. He was immediately condemned as a forger. And his heart was broken by this. And unfortunately, after he's died, his claims were shown to be true, and there was a famous French archaeologist who'd been very cynical, and he went there and finally was convinced when some cave paintings were found near Les Aisiers in France. No one knows what happened to the daughter, but I hope she had a happy life.
When looking at cave art like this, I am amazed. It's almost like the impulse to make art sort of sprang full bloom as soon as humans started to organize themselves.
There's an interesting development being literally since the book was written. Some Spanish archaeologists using fairly advanced dating methods are now claiming that the earliest cave paintings weren't painted by modern humans, but by Neanderthals.
Whoa.
This, to put it mildly, is controversial and is an issue which is going to get resolved. It is possible it goes back. I must confess, I think it's a modern human thing. I think it's tied in with cognitive abilities and thinking theoretically and ritual and all that.
But if you've, and I want to say this to the audience, if you have never seen the cave art of Altamira or Lascaux, it's mind-blowing because it is sort of beautifully abstracted things that people are familiar with. And then the great thing is the handprints where they've blown pigment around their hands as if to say, you know, I was here. It's an outstanding thing. Now, we go from that transcendent experience.
Now, may I say one thing?
Yeah.
Have you been to the caves?
No, because he can't get in anymore.
Oh, no. There are caves you can get into. Oh. There was one called Pechmerle, P-E-C-H-M-E-R-L-E, where you can see handprints and animals. Go. I suggest you shut your program down for a month and go. Seriously, it's well worth it.
Oh, my. Well, I want to go from that transcendent moment to one of the great early characters of archaeology, Heinrich Schliemann.
Oh, Heinrich, yeah, he was a crook.
Well, and I want to mention that there's some incredible people in the early history of archaeology that are just, man, somebody should be making a movie out of this. Let's talk about, he was bound and determined that he was going to uncover Troy.
He was obsessed with it. And I don't blame him. I was very lucky. I had a teacher in high school who loved Homer and would quote it, and he made us recite it. And you would get into the rhythm of the resonance of it. De, you know, Amos de Eriganaya Fanea Rectalus Heos. Then wow. Early rising, rosy dawn appeared. Rosy fingered dawn appeared. You got into the rhythm of it. It's an amazing story. And Homer, Schliemann got obsessed with this. But then he had, and we're only too familiar with this, a somewhat flexible morality. And he dug using engineers from the Suez Canal. It was not large scale. Immediately claimed that the mound of Hissarlik was Troy, found a treasure, which in fact probably he assembled from all sorts.
That was Priam's treasure, right? That was gonna, got to be Priam's treasure.
And of course, that vanished into the Soviet Union and only turned up after, in the last 20 years. So there really is. He's a very flamboyant character. One admires his energy and his push. And his wife, apparently, was really something. In old age, he was very formidable, apparently. So, you know, he was a major figure.
And again, in these early days of archaeology, he's just moving huge amounts of earth around,
yes,
trying to find those things that he knew was there, but with no care with the different layers that he was passing through.
No, and in fact, while he was working, the Germans up elsewhere were digging places like Olympia where the games were, and working with architects on site and saving the stuff and so on. And eventually, one of their students went to work with Schliemann at Troy to improve the excavation, which he did.
Now, there's so many – there's the story just gets incredibly complicated and global. After this, I just want to mention a couple of things. Who were the first important women in archaeology? Gertrude Bell and Harriet Boyd Hawes.
They were, yes. Gertrude Bell is very well known, partly because she wrote books herself and was quite a character, and she was also involved quite a bit on and off with T.E. Lawrence in the intelligence business.
Of Lawrence of Arabia.
Lawrence, as you say, of Arabia, and was a very early feminist, and was a rather tortured soul. But she did some superb work, not on excavation. She went to the ruins of Uqadir in Iraq, which was an old Islamic fortress, and recorded it. She did that sort of work, working alone with armed guards. I mean, she was really something. Harriet Hawes was a wonderful person. She was an activist who started off as an archaeologist, went on a fellowship to Greece, was told she wasn't allowed to excavate, met Arthur Evans, who was the excavator of the Minoans on Crete, who encouraged her to work on Crete, and she excavated a Minoan town, arriving there on a mule, and did it by herself with one other friend at times, and published it. This was an amazingly good piece of work. She then went on and got heavily involved in humanitarian activities in World War I and spent her life teaching. She only did that one big dig, but she was an amazing character.
We're almost out of time, and there is so much more we can talk about. Every chapter is cinematic in its layout. There's stories about the beginning of underwater archaeology, contemporary archaeology, which may not even dig anymore. But what was interesting to me is that you included Lewis and Mary Leakey's work in Old Louvre. Is that considered the beginning of the concerns of archaeology going back all the way to the ancient hominids of Africa?
No, it's not. Actually, first person who really got into fossil humans was Thomas Huxley back in 1863, when he described the Neanderthal skull and compared it to that of a chimpanzee. Then there was another find in the 1871 by a Eugene Dubois, a Dutchman, and he was laughed to scorn. He found Homo erectus in Asia. But the person who really started it was a remarkable flamboyant man whom I actually met quite a lot. Was a guy called Raymond Dart. He was an anatomist in South Africa who found Australopithecus, the southern ape, in South Africa. And the Leakey came along after him did some work in East Africa and there realized that was where he was going to find it. And then he and his second wife, Mary, excavated at Olduvai Gorge and found Zinjanthropus was the famous one.
Yep.
And I actually was there
one day
after they found another fossil of a later human. And years later, I was back there and I met Meave Leakey, who was Richard Leakey's wife, and told her I'd been there. I was the first person other than them to see it. And she looked at me and said, "My God, your history." So I felt rather elderly.
But that's a fascinating time period that they're talking about, because it's literally where paleontology meets archaeology.
Well, this is all. You see, I have to remember that archaeology ultimately is telling stories based on science.
That's right.
And that's what, hopefully, this book does.
It really does. It's an amazing book. My returning guest tonight has been Brian Fagan, Emeritus Professor of Anthropology, University of California, Santa Barbara. And we've been talking about his latest book. Totally enjoyable. Every chapter will bring you a new adventure, A Little History of Archaeology. Brian, it's been a pleasure.
Thank you so much for having me.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. Good night.